At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Gods, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Jay. How are you doing this morning?
Well, after the week I've had, I feel like I've just been escorted out of the theater. Hopefully things will turn around this morning.
Yeah, let's hope so. And certainly we have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about this morning. Before we do, actually, I want to let listeners know that we're planning our next listener choice, listener participation segment. That's for those our Patreon supporters at the $10 and higher level. That's going to be this following week. So that would be the 23rd. I'm doing scheduling in my head here. Never good. But we're not 100% sure about the time yet or whether it's going to be, whether I'll be joined by Jay or by May. We'll nail those details down the next few days. But if you are at that $10 level, we'll be sending you a message with the time and the Zoom link at some point by midweek. And if you're not, well, we hope you consider that if you're interested in taking part in an episode. So, but that is for next week. This week we have.
If you give it the $20 level, we'll let you know earlier.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll actually fill you in on the plans.
We're willing to do a sliding scale sort of thing here. Absolutely. So we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff today. The Hunter Biden indictment, the Houch impeachment inquiry, the auto workers strike, and depending on the time we have left, Mitt Romney's retirement and the fate of moderates in Congress, the new COVID boosters approved and where you're being urged to get them anywhere except for Florida, apparently, pandemic, unemployment insurance fraud. There's a lot of stuff. We surely won't get to all of it, but what we don't get to in the regular show, as always, Jay and I will tackle in the midweek show. And so, Jay, why don't we get going? All right. So to start with, late this week, special counsel David Weiss charged Hunter Biden with three felonies tied to his failure to disclose his illegal drug use when purchasing a handgun. The Colt Cobra that Biden purchased was discovered by Haley Biden, the widow of Hunter's brother, Beau, with whom Hunter was romantically involved at the time when she apparently threw it in the dumpster, concerned that Hunter might be planning to kill himself with it. And no, I'm not making any of that up. This is a serious family drama here. Now, if he's convicted, Biden faces a maximum of 25 years in prison and $750,000 in fines, though as a nonviolent first-time offender, it's unlikely that he'd be facing anything close to that. And this, of course, follows the collapse of that plea agreement between Biden and the government under which Biden was to have pleaded guilty to two misdemeanor tax charges, and then to not be prosecuted for the gun charges under a pretrial diversion agreement in which Biden would admit his drug use, agree not to attempt to buy a gun, or not use drugs or alcohol for 2 years. And that was what many Republicans characterized as a sweetheart deal. It fell apart when the judge in the case raised some, I would say, significant concerns about its structure and enforceability. So, Jay, what do you think about these gun charges and how do you see this playing out? I mean, Hunter Biden and Donald Trump as cellmates somewhere, that would be an interesting thing.
that'd be like a good show.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Here's the indictment that, you know, people thought may have come for a long time ago. I think the charges are pretty cut and dried, right? I mean, it's there's not a whole lot for us to talk about here as to what happens next. I don't know. I mean, maybe he gets another plea deal, a different plea deal, just going to the gun charges. Maybe he takes it to trial. I think the defense would be that this is a, partisan political witch hunt launched by Donald Trump and so forth. And you drive before the right jury, you could find a juror who would say, no, I'm not going to convict on that. So I think those are probably the two big directions it goes. The curious thing is, what happened to the tax charges, which to me, and I think to other Republicans are, what's much more interesting, just because there is the link, between him and, whoever the mysterious big guy might be. So I'm not, there's not a whole lot to talk about on the gun charges themselves. But it's also a matter of, I think Weiss, found himself in a corner of now he's got, a case that he couldn't just walk away from, the plea deal having fallen apart. So he had to do what he had to do on this. So
I want to come back to the tax charges that weren't filed, but still could be, and focus for a second here on those gun charges, because it seems to me you're right that clearly Biden lied on the form. And so when he got the gun, he possessed that gun illegally. Like you said, this is very cut and dried here. But I would imagine you would agree that this is the sort of thing that one wouldn't expect given his nonviolent.
Yeah. I wouldn't expect. No, not a significant sentence, given the circumstances surrounding it, the nonviolent part, I would not anticipate him. And I'm not a criminal law expert by any means. And I can look up what the sentencing guidelines stuff is, but I would not expect there to be any prison time accompanied with this, or it could be much easier, some sort of diversion type program. So,
and there is,
if there are others out there who know more about this, if there's any mandatory minimum or something like that, please correct me. But yeah, I wouldn't see any prison time attaching to this.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. But it seems to me there is one argument that Biden's team could make. It might be one that at least some folks on the right would really like.
Ooh, oh, yeah. Go ahead. I know what this is. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Last month, the Fifth Circuit actually struck down a federal law that prohibited illegal drug users from possessing firearms. And that's one of the things that Biden's been indicted for. And in the decision, the Chief Judge Jerry Smith wrote, "Our history and tradition may support some limits on an intoxicated person's right to carry a weapon, but it does not justify disarming a sober citizen based exclusively on his past drug usage, nor do more generalized traditions of disarming dangerous persons support this restriction on nonviolent drug users." And so this goes back to the Supreme Court's recent decision in the New York case. And there's a reasonable constitutional argument to be made here. And it seems to me that if Biden wanted to make that case, and that of course, that would work in the area of the Fifth Circuit, which Delaware isn't, but he would still be on the hook for lying on the form. But it seems to me at least one of those charges he was indicted on, you could argue is, if you're a Second Amendment sort of history and tradition sort of person, could argue is unconstitutional in the first place. And was that what you were thinking about?
Yeah, that's right. And that's not a bad argument at all. So there have been a couple other of these cases, some involving domestic violence, where courts have struck down prohibitions on weapons for domestic violence offenders. On that same ground, sort of like, well, look, when the Second Amendment was written and shortly thereafter, and domestic violence wasn't even a crime, right? So how could you say there was a history of tradition? Now the response is, and I think it's a good response, is, well, domestic violence may not have been a crime, but there was certainly the principle in the law and other examples of keeping people who have a propensity for violence from owning firearms. So I think you can make that argument. And it comes down to, when we talk about that history and tradition stuff that comes out of Bruin, are we talking about a, you know, these general principles or actual look, was there a statute? Was there not a statute? Maybe there's two levels of analysis, right? If it's easy, if you can say, well, yeah, there was a statute that prohibited this, or there was a statute that specifically allowed it, or there's a case that said something one way or the other. Otherwise, I think you get into that. Look, what's the principle we're talking about here?
Yeah, and that's why for a number of reasons why.
But the principle on this one, I do think there's some truth to it. I mean, I think most historians would agree that from about 1800 or like, you know, at least the 1820s to 1850s, absolutely everyone in America was drunk most all the time.
At least a little bit.
And also had access to firearms. Yeah, I mean.
Well, and to me, I think this illustrates why I'm skeptical or not a fan of the sort of history and tradition approach. I tend to favor much more of a balancing approach. And in this case, you know, obviously the balance, the question would be that Second Amendment right, which
sort of the levels of scrutiny, right?
Exactly.
The Second Amendment is a fundamental right, and therefore the government can still regulate fundamental rights, but they have to do so. They have to have a compelling interest and use the least restrictive means to do so.
Exactly. I think that's a far better test, but clearly the court disagrees with that. I feel like they sort of elevated the Second Amendment because, of course, the history and traditions test does make it more difficult to put restrictions on than, I think, generally speaking, than a balancing approach would. But I would argue that a balancing approach is, in many cases, more rational and more flexible. But that's an argument that I think
there's I was at a conference last week and there was some discussion on that sort of expansion of where does Bruin go next. And I think there's stuff to be fleshed out there, right? Because I think the history and tradition test worked specifically pretty well in Bruin, right? Where you were talking about what amounted to an outright prohibition, but these other pieces that are limited prohibitions, what I'm saying is Bruin was sort of an easy call. These other ones are less so. So I think the court's going to have to deal with it, and they haven't yet. And it may be some sort of hybrid test that we get to. I don't know, but yeah, we've talked about this before, but I have issues, concerns about Bruin for a number of reasons. Just on the workability of the test. So,
and moving to the tax charges, while there haven't been charges filed, certainly Weiss could still do that, and that may be in the works. And so I'm going to withhold judgment on that because under the plea deal, those were two misdemeanor charges, and I think I'm going to, like I said, withhold judgment until we see actually if there are charges forthcoming, because there certainly could be, right?
There certainly could be, although the argument, and I think you'll see this on both cases, right? The argument is Hunter's going to say, look, we had a deal that you weren't going to prosecute on this, regardless of whether the judge approved an actual plea, right? And I think that's going to come up with those. But to me, it's a little puzzling that they didn't add the tax stuff because they already have it in the can, so to speak, right? It's not like there was any additional work or investigation. We had all these charges ready to go before.
Certainly the gun charge is an easier case because, I mean, it's about as straightforward as one can imagine. I mean, there's no question that he lied on that form. And so that's, like I said, that's about as straightforward as it gets, whereas the tax charges are maybe a little more disputable, I guess, reasonably disputable than that.
Yeah. Well, I could even, you know, look, Mike, I could even come up with arguments to say that it's not undisputable that he lied or that he violated the statute.
I understand what you're saying.
But I don't think those would be great arguments.
Sure.
I think you could, is the statute so vague that you say, well, am I addicted? Well, I don't know. I'm not a, you know, addict. I'm just a cocaine enthusiast. What I mean? It's sure. There are levels of that kind of thing. So
yeah, no, that's fair. Certainly. And of course, this is related to the larger story. It's not like House Republicans or Republicans in general care much about Hunter Biden per se. It's about, as you call it, the big guy, right? And for folks who don't know, Jay's referring to some communications from Biden talking about Hunter Biden talking about the big guy's cut and so forth. And clearly, Biden is making allusions to his dad. And the question there being whether or not the big guy in question actually knew anything about this, approved of this, got any money from this, or if Hunter Biden was just throwing his dad's name around in an attempt to make deals, essentially, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And exactly. That's one of the things, apparently, that...
Although, again, as a lawyer, I would say, no, it's not clear that that's who the big guy is.
Okay, sure. Well, absolutely. I would hope so.
I'm putting on my lawyer hat today, Mike, to defend Hunter Biden, of all people.
And defend Joe Biden, in this case, right? Because the big guy,
I'm like John Adams defending the...
There you go. The British at the Bunker Hill.
Boston Massacre. Yep. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I have to Boston. Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, that's good. So, but the point being, right, is that this is clearly focused on Joe Biden, not Hunter Biden. And that kind of leads us to what happened this week when Kevin McCarthy, I'm almost feeling sorry for Kevin McCarthy. I can't believe it's ever come to that. But he announced an impeachment inquiry into President Biden. And this was made without a vote of the full House, despite the fact that only 11 days before, McCarthy told Breitbart News that, I quote, "the American people deserve to be heard on this matter through their elected representatives. That's why if we move forward with an impeachment inquiry, it would occur through a vote on the floor of the People's House and not through a declaration by one person." So, McCarthy's pretty rapid reversal here. Pretty clearly, it's an attempt to placate extremists in the Freedom Caucus who have threatened to force a vote, removing him from his position or multiple votes if he doesn't meet their demands. And that's both demands for a Biden impeachment and spending cuts that are significantly deeper than were agreed to in the debt ceiling deal in late May. But right now, at least to me, it looks like McCarthy isn't getting much, really, if anything, for selling out his principles such as they might be. I mean, you know, because to me, it's sort of there's no indication that I've seen that the sort of extremist flank of his caucus is at all interested in supporting a CR, continuing resolution to keep the government operating after September 30th. And also, I think if McCarthy tries to pull in any Democratic votes, he's almost certain. I mean, Matt Gaetz has been pretty clear. Hey, it's going to be, we do the pledge, it's a motion to vacate, and we're just going to keep on doing that sort of thing. And that, of course, if you think back, that was part of the deal to make him speaker on that 15th ballot, where any member can make a motion to vacate. That's a privileged motion, which means you drop everything, do that first. And then if a majority agrees, McCarthy would be removed, the new speaker would have to be elected. So I bring that up, Jay.
And I believe at the time I said that was a pretty bad deal.
Well, yeah.
And I think you were less like, it's never going to happen.
Well, I mean, I don't think he's going to be removed because the votes aren't there. But let's obviously these two things are related.
They can still throw it up to, yeah, just gum up the works.
Exactly. So let's focus first on the impeachment inquiry and McCarthy clear. I don't think you would. Really, even if you put on your lawyer, well, take your lawyer hat off for a second, just your regular person hat. I mean, it's pretty clear that McCarthy said one thing and did another, and he pretended to have these principles, or maybe he does have these principles, that he just basically, I don't feel that saying sold them out is unfair, but what do you think about that?
Yes. You know, I'm a little disappointed. I mean, I guess, you know, a couple things. One, if you're going to make the promise, then you have to sort of be sure you have the votes to back it up. And it could be he didn't count right. Didn't have the votes to back it up. I find that a little hard to believe because again, my sense is take the vote anyway. If you lose, well, okay. There's still other investigations that can proceed, right?
The Comer investigation still going on.
Comer investigation. There's all sorts of other avenues that you can keep investigating the president and his potential connections to, you know, overseas money and all that. I think, you know, the putting the impeachment label on it, in some sense raised the profile of those investigations. And I think this is something that's a little weird when we talk about media bubbles, because I read and I understood that there were a lot of folks on the left who were just sort of shocked, surprised, you know, where did this come from? Where on the right, well, look, this is something we've been talking about for months. And I think it is just sort of the media bubbles that people inhabit. But yeah, you know, putting the impeachment label on it, all of a sudden the media now is covering this more than they apparently were before. It was maybe to calling it an impeachment inquiry, maybe isn't great. There's sort of the, Chekhov line, the Russian playwright, not the Starship Navigator, that if you show a gun in the first act, you better use it in the second. So I think once you say impeachment, right, the launch sequence has started, and there's no turning back. This is true with when the Democrats did it, with Trump. And I think it's true now, that once you say that word, then it's, you got to launch, eventually.
Yeah. Because I'm trying to think about this strategically, where I don't really think the Freedom Caucus people give a damn about that.
No. They want to launch. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not.
But I mean, it seems to me that you're essentially putting the small but critical number of House Republican moderates in a horrible position. And I can understand why McCarthy, if you're the leader, I mean, he's the speaker, sure, but I mean, he focuses on, you know, helping his majority out.
He made the right political call by not calling the vote, because it would have hurt moderates potentially.
Exactly. Force your folks to make a vote that's going to hurt them, essentially. So I can understand doing that, but I think that in principle, he's right that for something as significant as this, it should be. I agree with the argument he made back when he was very vociferously protesting what Nancy Pelosi did, right? And that first thing, saying that, no, this is so serious that having one person announcement is, but I understand politically why he did. But of course, that just kind of moves the difficult vote on, because I find it almost inconceivable to believe that once an impeachment inquiry has been launched, like you said, that gun has been produced, now it will be used at some point. So there will be a vote on whether or not to impeach Joe Biden. That, I think, is a near certainty. And talk about that's a much tougher vote than an impeachment inquiry thing. So
the gamble is that, through the re-inquiry, you'll find enough evidence that will make that vote
sure
a lot easier.
Okay. Yeah. That's fair. Yeah.
But you don't, again, it's a gamble, because you don't know that yet.
Yeah. And certainly there is, I'll say this, I don't live in a media bubble so much. I read the Wall Street Journal and other, right of side. I read the New York Post, my God, pretty much every day. So, but it seems to me that people on the right are fair in saying that Joe Biden has lied, or at least changed his story about his knowledge of and communication with his son and people involved with his son's business dealings. I mean, that to me is almost incontrovertible, given just looking at the record. Now, whether it goes further than that, I don't know. But I'll also say that I can understand the case for an impeachment inquiry, in that makes it almost certainly easier for the House to get access to documents that they wouldn't, that would be more challenging to do. Because I put it this way.
And I suppose I should have added that when I said, it raises the profile of the media. But yeah, it also has that secondary benefit of the idea of, this isn't just some goofy committee chairman on a witch hunt. This is a big, serious national. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. But
Well, no, no, but you know, I'm sure by labeling it.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
It's not just the committee investigating this; it's the impeachment inquiry. Yeah.
This right? is. So. Let me be clear. This is not a big nothing burger. There is that Hunter Biden has done some sleazy, shady, unethical, almost certainly, it seems to me, illegal stuff. Always the presumption of innocence, and clearly he has implicated his dad in that. And so the question is, I mean, he's not directly done that, but in his communications. And so
I feel there's smoke there.
Yeah, exactly. I feel Congress would not be doing its job if it didn't investigate this. Now, that said, Comer's committee has not to this point issued, as far as I know, a single subpoena. They've made requests. And so I find it more than a little bit disingenuous saying, well, you know, they haven't been cooperating, so we need this impeachment inquiry. That doesn't pass the smell test. But that said, certainly now that it's at that point, it's probably going to be marginally easier for them to get a court, a federal judge to go along and to force compliance with subpoenas under an impeachment inquiry than under this committee activity. Though, as long as the committee shows a legitimate legislative purpose, and they have ethics law, you know, regular ethics laws, right? So, again, I think it's important to not make this a black or white thing. There's something here that absolutely is worth investigating, but this is also absolutely a political investigation.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, and that's, and I think both are fine. Well, I mean, Watergate was a political investigation, but you know, so I mean, but it was something that needed investigated. So
yeah, absolutely. So moving on to the kind of connection to the government shutdown aspect of it, because again, this year's current year budget runs out at September 30th, and it's looking increasingly like there will be a shutdown. What do you think? Do you see that happen? How do you see this whole thing playing out? I know in the past you've said government shutdowns tend to hurt Republicans, but it seems like there is a group of Republicans who are hell bent.
I think I've said government shutdowns always hurt Republicans.
Yeah. So do you think that happens again?
I'm hopeful that there is not a shutdown. I think there's going to be some brinksmanship, but I think McCarthy will find a way to rein in enough Freedom Caucus members to get this done. I think he may well play the card of like, look, if there's a shutdown and we're blamed for it, and we will be because we always are, you know, we could lose those couple seats, and there go your investigations, there goes your impeachment. I suppose you would say, well, it wouldn't matter by then, but still, I think it's the political air goes out of the balloon at that point, right?
Well, yes, I see your
it's
point.
One thing to be on the ascendancy, right? The other to be scrambling and defending of why you allowed the government to shut down. So I'm hopeful that there's going to be sort of another CR at some point, because there usually is. So yeah, other than that, I don't have predictions. The other thing that I've you know, read and heard in a lot of media outlets, and again, this isn't anything I've got any inside track on, but I think it's interesting. To the extent that folks are saying, well, the impeachment inquiry was meant to buy grace from the, can you buy grace? I guess that's a weird theological question. Maybe I misused that. Buy peace, with the Freedom Caucus. It seems to be a non-starter, the idea being that the Freedom Caucus views the impeachment inquiry as something different than the spending issues on the government shutdown. So it's not as if the Freedom Caucus is going to back down just because now there's an impeachment inquiry. I suppose you're from McCarthy, you can say, well, hell, it doesn't hurt. Now they're only mad at me about one thing as opposed to two. But yeah, it's not a thing of there's no quid pro quo there.
I think the problem is that McCarthy maybe is and some old school Republicans sort of labor under the misconception that some sort of transactional bargaining sort of thing can happen with these folks. And maybe you're right, with some of the Freedom Caucus members that's possible, but I think for a number of them, at least a small number of them, that's they don't care about losing the majority. That doesn't affect. In fact, you could argue that they would feel.
Right. It may not. That may not, in fact, affect them personally.
Yeah. Exactly. And given the fact that McCarthy can afford to lose so few votes, that all it takes is a handful of those folks, which is why I think that there will almost certainly be a shutdown. I hope it won't be a long one. And certainly I would hope it hurts Republicans, you know, but I mean, they've been setting this up for a while, because if you take a look at what House appropriators have done, they've basically been the bills that have moved forward and they haven't gotten to the floor yet, that they've been violating that debt ceiling deal in a bunch of ways, not on the Senate side. The Senate appropriators have pretty much on both sides have kept to that deal, but the House has just been like, oh, the hell with this. Let's just do whatever we want and go lower than these agreed upon levels. And they've been setting this up for a while. And so I think it is fairly inevitable.
Well, there's no I in team, Mike, but there is an I in Republicans. So I think that's, you know, I mean, I would hope that the Freedom Caucus would sort of try to be better team players and look at the bigger picture on this.
Wow. Did you just hear? I just repeat that sentence. If I heard correctly, well, no, I hope that the Freedom Caucus will be team players.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, there's something to holding, you know, everybody's feet to the fire and all that sort of thing. And I'm all for that. But let's not blow up, let's not self-sabotage for ideology. I mean, I think it's better to be, you know, and again, I could run through like a whole bunch of cliches here, right? About half a loaf is better than nothing, and don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and all that kind of stuff, right? But they're cliches to some extent because they're true.
Well, they're only true if your goal is to get something done for the greater good. And I would suggest that to Matt Gaetz and
which
some
is,
other
again, to me,
folks,
yeah,
that, yeah.
You know, team player. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know,
here's the thing here. I mean, here's the thing. Look, if you lose the House, all the, you know, well, you're not going to get any spending limits. You're not going to get any more investigations. You're not.
But that's not the real question. The question is, I think for a small but a crucial number of folks, extremists on the right, is how does this affect my fundraising? How does this affect my electoral chances? Yeah. Because honestly, if this doesn't have it, if it hurts my fundraising, even if we retain the House, I would rather do what's better for my fundraising, even though we lose the House. And I think that's the calculation that, you know, maybe it's not a lot of them are making, but if it's a half dozen, a dozen of them, that's all you need. That you can't afford to lose those if you're McCarthy.
Yeah. Well, and that is maybe a change in just because of the internet, I suppose, if you want to argue that. But the way fundraising, you know, has worked, and there was a time where more of the funding, and it still happens, obviously, was directed out of caucus leadership. You're right. If you have a lot of members who have their own significant source of funding and can tell leadership, go to hell, I don't need any money from you. That changes the dynamic, and you could argue it changes the dynamic for good or for bad.
Do you think there'll be motions to vacate? It seems like Matt Gaetz is just itching to do that.
Again, I think, show the gun in the first act. You better use it in the second.
And so then I'm wondering, that puts Democrats in an interesting position, right? Because if Democrats want to, they could throw the House into complete turmoil by just saying, yeah, we never voted for Kevin McCarthy in the first place. And so, yeah, we don't want him to be speaker either. And so, boom, there's your majority. And then all of a sudden, the House just grinds to a complete halt. And I don't think Democrats would do that, but certainly that puts them in something of a maybe not a bargaining position. But this is why I started this off by saying I almost feel sorry.
Kevin, we can save your bacon here. Yeah.
Yeah. I almost feel sorry for Kevin McCarthy, except he came into this with his eyes open. He knew what he was getting into. He saw what happened to the last couple of Republican speakers. Republicans have just been brutal to their speakers. And it's been these nuts on the far right who have just eviscerated the last couple of speakers. I mean, who would want this job? Who would want to try to, I don't know. It's wow. Which is why, you know, no, it's better if we have a Democrat.
That's why, yeah, to me, it's a source of frustration that the Republican urge to self-destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. So
you
do
know,
you think
circular firing squads and all that kind of stuff? And again, all the cliches you want to throw out there, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, kind of thing. But
yeah, well, I'm all for that. You know,
I know you are. Yes, yeah.
So do you think Kevin McCarthy keeps the speaker's gavel?
I do.
And so just.
I think there's going to be, yeah, there's going to be some yelling and shouting and gumming up the works and everything we just talked about. But I think he still has most of the votes in the House and in the House Republican caucus. And for Democrats, he's the, you know, like the devil they know and likely the lesser evil.
And he's got Marjorie Taylor Greene on his side. So, you know, what else could you want? I'm moving on to something very different. On Friday, just yesterday, recording this Saturday morning, nearly 13,000 auto workers at three plants targeting each of the so-called big three automakers went on strike. That's the big three, by the way, if you don't know, Ford, GM, and Stellantis. You might not have heard of them, but they're the Dutch company.
Chrysler.
Yeah. Ram, Jeep, Chrysler, that sort of thing. Now, the demands of the United Auto Workers include a 36% wage hike over 4 years and a 32-hour work week with all work over that paid at overtime wages, and less use of temporary workers. Those are the key demands, at least. The automakers have offered somewhere between 17.5% and 20% raises over a 4.5-year contract. The union has rejected this as insufficient after years of inflation, with consumer prices rising somewhere around 20% since the auto workers signed their last contract in 2019. And currently, full-time employees at the big three make somewhere between $18 to $32 an hour, depending on their level of seniority. Now, the union has argued that while worker wages haven't kept up with inflation, CEO compensation has shot way up. For instance, since the last labor contract in 2019, GM CEO Mary Barra, her compensation up 34%, $29 million in 2022. Ford CEO Jim Farley saw a 21% gain, $21 million last year. And Stellantis is a little different because they didn't even exist in 2019, but their current CEO, Carlos Tavares, he pulled in around $25 million last year. And the union has also pointed out that since 2019, annual gross profits have risen 34% at Ford, 50% at GM, and Stellantis, again, 2021, they were founded. They increased their gross profits since then by, I believe, 19%. And that 36% I mentioned is actually down from the initial proposal of a 40% pay bump. And the union's also asking for the reestablishment of cost of living adjustments, retiree medical benefits. Both of those things were lost in the last round of bargaining in 2019. President Biden weighed in. He's sending White House Economic Advisor Gene Sperling and Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu to Detroit to help both sides try to come to an agreement, although it's pretty clear Biden is at least somewhat taking sides. He said that while no one wants to strike, he respects workers' collective bargaining rights, understands their frustration, and believes that automakers should ensure that their record profits mean record contracts for the UAW. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on this strike and the UA and the auto workers' demands?
Well, a couple things. We're sort of back to the theme this week is shooting yourself in the foot. And I think the demands are over broad, but we'll see how this plays out. The other thing I would point out is that profits are you know, year to year, contracts are forever, or at least for a set term. Meaning, you know, you could say, listen, automakers were extremely profitable, and they were. You also talked about gross profits, which is different, obviously, than their net profit. But you know, there was a huge burst in 2020, 2021 that I think the automakers are riding off of, and we'll see if that, you know, I don't know that you know, there were sales and price increases that were due to a bunch of weird factors, right? Pandemic and stimulus payments and so forth, and contracted supply and all these things. I don't know whether that's going to be the case down the road. So, look, if they're gonna strike, and we'll see where this ends up. But I think the big three are in not good shape, you know, in any meaningful sense of the word. So,
what do you mean by that? I mean,
I think just they're caught in a situation where their most profitable products that they sell are the ones that the government is trying to stop them from selling. they want the move to electric, but they, you know, these companies lose money on electric. So it's sort of this catch 22, right? The electric push is going to keep coming. But they have to be able to find a way to remain profitable making and selling electric vehicles, which so far they haven't. They've just subsidized that with the sale of your bigger trucks and so forth. So that's what I'm saying is an ongoing problem. They've got to figure that out. And I think there's a lot of analysts have said, look, the real winner in this has been, will be Tesla.
Right, because they have figured out how to do this at a profit. Now, they're non-union, and that certainly, but it also helps that Tesla started out in electric, and the big three tend to be, if you go back in history, it took them quite a long time to meet the challenge of Asian car makers and German car makers to a lesser extent in the 1970s and into the 80s. And that was a really rough transition period. And I think they definitely fear the same thing. And so, I mean, you have some fair points, and I think we can't just discount their arguments that, hey, we're worried about this electric future, and we haven't figured this out. And so while we have record profits now, how is this? We need to invest billions of dollars in this technology just to keep pace, because, okay, Tesla only has a small market share now, but that's been growing quite a lot, and they're making money off their electric vehicles. And so those are some, if I'm Mary Barra or Jim Farley, I look at that, and that's a serious competitive threat to me a few years down the road.
Yeah. And you know, the other piece that I think maybe the union is not looking at, but I would expect that the car makers would be, is, you know, who doesn't ask for increases and doesn't go on strike are robots. I think, and we're living in a world where, you know, increasing labor costs can much more easily be responded to by automation. Obviously, there's already been a ton of automation in this industry,
the nature of electric vehicles, they tend to have fewer parts, require fewer workers to put together, and the unions are not. So in a way, you have the big three.
Why is Joe Biden killing American jobs?
You have the big three not crazy about electric vehicles because, like you said, they make their money on the big trucks and SUVs and so forth that are largely not electric. And then you have the workers who aren't crazy about them because they can be made with fewer workers. But then again, I mean, why is Joe Biden? Well, Joe Biden's not trying to kill American jobs. And certainly the labor market as a whole is extremely healthy. But Joe Biden is concerned that we don't destroy the environment. And hey, I think that's a reasonable concern. So this isn't being done because Joe Biden thinks, well, let's just screw up the economy. There are some legitimate climate concerns here.
Sure.
But that said,
you know, again, there's, I am, the more I think of these conversations of ours over the years, the more I come to the realization that my position, and I think the free market Republican position, is and ought to be, and it's the Milton Friedman, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Ain't no such thing as a free lunch. There's trade-offs, right? And you know, at some point you have to be realistic about those trade-offs. So if you want to say, listen, we want electric vehicles because we think that's going to be better for the environment. This is going to be our policy going forward. Well, fair enough. But here's the trade-off. You're going to have less of these union jobs. And I think that's, you know,
I think that's a reason. I think that's a fair trade-off. I think it's almost always a mistake in the long term.
The people who will be out of work would disagree with you, but yeah.
Well, yeah, and that's why it's not obviously, I would argue, not quite that straightforward, because you don't just say, well, hit the road, Jack, and figure it out on your own. I think that's a big problem that we failed to adequately appreciate and address kind of in those waves of globalization that we've seen, just assuming that, well, workers will figure out retraining. Well, you tell some 50-year-old auto worker, hey, you know, go figure it out. That's not very helpful at all. And we have underinvested to an incredible, shockingly unacceptable amount in worker retraining and reeducation. And we need to do a lot more with that, but we can't just say, well, we have to forego efficiency gains so we can keep people employed. That's incredibly short-sighted. And I think that's the free market sort of approach, but we can't just let these workers just say, well, figure it out on your own. That's also a free market approach. So I guess I half agree with you, if that makes sense. Because I mean, we agree on the point that making automaking less efficient to provide for more jobs is a bad idea for the economy and for everyone in the long run. But also, it's not okay to just lay people off and let them figure it out on their own. Or maybe you think that's okay.
To some extent, here's the issue when you get into the, okay, we'll train people to do something else. Well, what's going to be the something else? And how do you know that that's the right thing to train them for?
Well, you don't.
Right. This comes back to sort of a market dynamism type argument. And to me, the bigger question would be, look, if you just had the government be less involved with industry in the first place, you know, these trade-offs would sort themselves out on more of a micro level. But if we're going to have, you know, government policies that are going to impact products that are made and the jobs of the people who make them, there's going to be a trade-off. And then, okay, well, what's the cost of that? And how do we compensate for that? Well, if the compensation is another government policy that's going to require some other trade-off, you know, again, you start getting into a it's difficult to plan all these things, right? And that's not, I'm not even saying that's the government's fault. I'm saying that's just the nature of the world we live in. There are plenty of jobs, have become or will become obsolete based on technology. You know, the big retraining push is always into healthcare. I had served on the Cuyahoga County Workforce Development Board years ago. And that was the sense of, well, what we need to do is to train these people to go into healthcare, which, look, is a huge growth industry. It's huge here in Northeast Ohio, in Ohio in general. But it's not necessarily limitless, and the skills are not necessarily transferable. It was easy to take, someone who worked on X type of machine in a factory and retrain them to go run Y type of machine in a factory. Yeah, I mean, there's a learning curve, but it's still the same core skill sets, right?
Or close enough. Sure. I understand what you're saying. An entirely different industry. That is not necessary. And some people are just not suited for that in various ways.
Take the auto worker. Yeah.
I mean, you can't just take an auto worker and say, hey, you could be a home health aide.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I see your point. But then again, the question is, what happens to these people?
Well, I don't know. And no one knows. I mean, okay.
Well, you do the best you can. You try to make sure that opportunities are made available to them, and understanding that you can't put everyone in a similarly good job. That's just the nature of economic transition in our economy. But you can't just let them fend for themselves. And you know, you're right that it's oftentimes you're looking in the rearview mirror when making these decisions. So it's you want to give the displaced workers the maximum amount of flexibility to try to fit into as quickly as possible, and also try to provide transitional funding while they're doing that.
Yeah, no, and I agree with all that, right? I'm not saying you get rid of safety net, get rid of unemployment, get rid of programs that provide job training and allow people to transition to different industries. I'm just saying it's not as if you can just flip another switch.
Sure.
And say, okay, we're just going to take these people and move them over, train them to do this, and then everybody will be employed. There's going to be a cost. There's going to be a human cost.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I got to say, I don't think you would blame either the UAW for taking the position they're taking. I mean, their job is to advocate for their members. It's not their job to worry about the American economy as a whole, just like it's not the job of the automakers to worry about that, right? Those are political decisions.
I think you could say it is their job to worry about the American automaking economy.
Well, sure. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it's their primary job is to advocate for their members in the near term. And that's what they're doing, just like the automakers are doing the same thing. And so I think people are quick to point out, you know, the short-sightedness and greed of the automakers or the union members, depending on which side of it you're on. But I always say, well, these are economic actors rationally pursuing their self-interest. And if you want something that looks kind of takes a broader view, well, that's where the political system is supposed to sort of organize this and kind of set the terms of the debate and that sort of thing. And so I wouldn't expect the UAW to say, you're right. We're really concerned about the electric thing too. We get it. Well, we'll take whatever they're giving us because we're worried about, you know, that's
I'm not saying you take whatever they're giving us. And I'm not suggesting negotiating strategy for either side. I'm just pointing out, there's cost.
Sure, absolutely.
To do this. Absolutely. There's risk to do this.
To your point that, you know, government just should try to stay out of this as much as possible, I think maybe in some libertarian dream world that's possible. But remember, it was in 2008, 2010, the automakers were having huge problems. And what did government do?
Oh yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, bail them out.
I didn't like that either, Mike.
But my point being is that they have the economic and political power that they are going to be judged by policymakers to be too big to fail, and so they're always going to be bailed out. If you get an industry large enough and important enough, it protects itself by its very size. And so the idea that government isn't going to intervene, I think, is just a non-starter.
Mike, I remember when, again, as a young high school student, being really upset with Ronald Reagan for allowing the Chrysler bailout.
Wow.
And that was Reagan. That was 1985. So at least I can say I'm being consistent. But the other, you know, look, and this, I will throw out, again, part of, we did our origin stories that one day. But I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, which is at one point, one of the steelmaking capitals of the world. And,
not anymore.
There's very little steel made there anymore. And it devastated the region. And, steel workers were extremely well paid, and you could say justifiably so. It's a horrible, dangerous job that they did. But the fact is that those level of wages could not keep up with one, automation, and two, foreign labor. In that period of time, you know, again, in the sort of that halcyon days, right, of the World War II through the
50s to the 70s,
late 60s, where in essence we didn't really have any serious global competitors, in a lot of cases because of the war, so much infrastructure had been destroyed. But when they built back that infrastructure, it was better than what it was. It was more modern. There were a lot of places then that could compete that didn't compete with us before, and we had trouble doing that. And that's again, realistic trade off position. You can also say, well, my God, the air was so bad in Youngstown. And in the 60s, in the 50s, people would talk about just, you wouldn't see the sun for weeks. It's this haze from the steel plants. And again, I'm not old enough to remember that. That would have been before my time. But all I'm saying is when the government gets involved and says we're going to pursue X policy, that you can't simply wash your hands. The consequences.
Sure, absolutely, and
maybe that's being a little harsh. Maybe, you know, listen, let's be honest with what the trade-offs are going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the reality of the situation is Tesla can make vehicles at a labor cost of somewhere between $45 and $50 an hour. The big three is somewhere between $64 to $67 an hour, and that's just not in a increasingly EV world. That's going to be eventually unsustainable for the big three. And that's a reality that has to be dealt with. And so I get that.
Well, you would say, where would these displaced workers go? Well, maybe they go work for Tesla. Maybe they go work for Honda of America. Those are some of the other.
Well, yes, but no, because labor is not nearly as mobile as capital is. And so oftentimes it's easy to say, well, just move yourself to North Carolina or Alabama and go work for another. You know, that's uproot yourself and your community and all that, because you can go there and get the same job at lower wages with fewer benefits in an entirely different community and part of the country. I mean, that's not a real
thing to be a home health care aide.
What's that? Yeah. Well,
or
I mean,
we'll train you to be a whole. So, like I say, I'm not saying that, all these choices are good or there's an ideal choice. I'm saying, here's what we've got. Maybe it is you don't like anything we're serving, but that's what we've got. If you understand me. So,
what do you think about? Okay, well, the one aspect of this we haven't talked about yet. I mentioned it in the intro.
This is really funny because when you floated this, I thought, geez, what am I going to have to say about the strike?
But here we are. There you go. But the one aspect we haven't talked about is the CEO salaries. I mean, that compensation is like way up there, right? And so, what's if you're the automakers? Talking to, I mean, what's your response to the workers about, well, hey, how come it's okay for the CEO to get a 34% pay bump and you're blanching at us getting, what we're asking for? I mean, how do you justify Mary Barra getting $29 million to an assembly line worker?
Well, I don't know that you do, other than you could say, listen, that's what the stockholders, the shareholders think she's worth. And maybe she isn't. I think that's, that's a question for the shareholders of these companies. Are you paying your CEOs too much? Maybe. But I just approach the world in a different way. I shouldn't say this because I know you have the capability of approaching it in this way too. But if you look at things from a market standpoint, participants get paid what the market will bear. And there's nothing fair about that. There's nothing fair or good or bad. It's just sort of like it is, right?
Well, yes and no. I see what you're saying, but let me just stop you, because the CEO market is a weird market in some ways it almost operates like a little cartel, because right. you have,
well, I would say it's almost like professional sports.
Well, yes and no, but it's the CEO market is weird because not only is it a very a skill set that not necessarily a lot of people have, but the people who are on the compensation committees deciding that are oftentimes CEOs themselves, and compensation levels are often based, are typically based on what other similar CEOs are getting. And so when you're on one of these compensation committees making a decision about CEO salaries, you're often in an indirect way helping set your salary range. And so it's not really a competitive market in the same way that a lot of other markets are. And I think that needs to be, a lot of people don't recognize the weird way in which CEO compensation is set. And so I would argue that I would agree that in a competitive marketplace, the market decides what you're worth, but this is a distorted marketplace with some perverse incentives.
I suppose that's right. But again, the cure would be shareholders saying, "Hey, we're paying our CEO." Now, again, I think the argument would tend to be, again, it's like a professional sports. Well, look, we want the best quarterback in the league. We're going to pay X much more for him. And I think there's that mentality sometimes among your board members who do the actual, you know, running of the company. But CEO salary to say, listen, is it fair that the quarterback field gets paid $20 million a year versus what the hot dog vendor gets paid? Well, no, it's not fair. But you look at the skill sets and
sure. The argument is that,
those people.
Yeah, a lot of people can be a fantastic hot dog vendor, but only a few people can be a fantastic NFL quarterback. Absolutely. I mean, that's how markets work. No question. So do you think, kind of pulling back and looking at this, do you think that this is likely to be settled anytime soon? I mean, the auto workers have a pretty significant strike fund. And they can go from, I believe I've seen as much as 11, 12 weeks. What do you think? Does this get the both sides kind of see the benefit of ironing this out fairly soon? Or how do you?
I think if they're smart, it will settle fairly soon. If both sides have a realistic understanding of their strengths and weaknesses, I don't know enough to say if that's the case yet. Look, I don't necessarily have all the knowledge of strengths and weaknesses, obviously, that the negotiators have. But to me, that's the key to any negotiation, right? Is knowing the cards you're holding and having a sense of what the cards the other side's holding. And I look at this and say, wow, there's a lot of risk on both sides. Is it going to be worth? How much is it going to be worth fighting over in terms of, and again, I think.
Right. Because I mean, the longer, I should point out that while the UAW has a big strike fund, that the workers are getting $500 a week. And after a while that starts to pinch more than a little bit, especially for those who are used to a lot more than that. So it's, there are incentives.
And management can sit and start doing the math as to, all right, what do we have to do in terms to raise our prices or spend some of this money that we would have been spending on labor on techno upgrades that are going to reduce our need for labor in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. And then, and also factor in that is how much are we losing every week in the course of this, and how much of that could we put for? How much could we put forth toward more concessions and so forth? That reaches a point of diminishing returns, and so I hope you're right that within a few weeks this gets ironed out.
Yeah, and I would say the last bit that I would throw out there is the Biden administration. The last thing in the world it wants is labor unrest. It's all sort of well and good, to go and say, oh, I support the rights of collective bargaining and I'm with the workers and all that kind of stuff. And that scores some political points in the short term. But I think in the long term, particularly with, inflation not necessarily beaten yet, the last thing the Biden administration wants is to have these sorts of labor problems popping up.
Extensive long-term thing that could end up having a significant economic impact. Absolutely. All right. Well, I think that does it for us for this regular weekend news update show. And though there was a bunch of stuff we didn't get to, we will get to that in the midweek show. Like, again, Mitt Romney's announced retirement, those new COVID boosters and Florida's response and pandemic unemployment insurance fraud. And if you are a supporter, you will get to hear all of that in the full midweek show. If you're not a supporter, we hope you'll consider becoming one because you'll get that full midweek show, not just a short preview that you get. You get ad-free versions of everything we put out, other stuff as well, like the ability to be part of our supporter participation shows and a bunch of other stuff. To check it all out, patreon.com/politicsguys. You can support us on Venmo at Politics Guys, also through PayPal. We always have those links in the show notes as well as at politicsguys.com/support. But we know that not everyone is financially in the position to support the podcast right now. Maybe you're a struggling auto worker. I don't know. But if that is you, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up with full access to the complete midweek show every week. And regardless of whether you're a supporter or not, it really helps us out if you can spread the word. That means subscribing to us, rating and reviewing us on your podcast app you're using, and sharing episodes on social media. And if you want to get in touch with us for any reason, mail@politicsguys.com works, as well as the Discord channel for supporters. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you will find links to that in the show notes. And as always, before we go, a very special thanks to our fantastic executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.